of what in my mind would be a great reality is that all students, whether they know it or not, would be in, as you said earlier, this career-connected learning experience. I think for our nation, that's going to be the solution to the future.
This is The Power of Career-Connected Learning with Hans Meter. This podcast is for education leaders who are working on the front lines of change. In this series, Hans Meter, president of the National Center for College and Career Transitions, interviews thought leaders and expert practitioners from across the United States, unlocking their secrets of success. Here's your host, Hans Meter.
Hello, welcome to The Power of Career-Connected Learning. I'm your host, Hans Meter. Since its earliest conception in the 1910s, career technical education has been at the intersection between public education and the workforce. As CTE has evolved over the past 100 years, it has also expanded its scope to include exploration of and preparation for hundreds of career paths, from the traditional paths like the skilled trades to healthcare and information technology and biotech, among many others. Where does CTE stand today and where is it headed? These are the questions that I discuss with Scott Stump, the Assistant Secretary for Career Technical and Adult Education at the U.S. Department of Education. Scott was confirmed by the U.S. Senate on July 16, 2018, and he serves as the principal advisor to the Secretary of Education on all matters concerning high schools, career technical and adult education, as well as community colleges, the workforce, and economic development. Prior to assuming his role at the U.S. Department of Education, Scott worked in the private sector, as the state director for CTE in Colorado, as a staff member with the National FFA, and earlier as a classroom agriculture teacher. We have Scott's full resume listed in the show notes, as well as some links to information that we refer to during today's interview. Welcome to the show today, Scott. I really appreciate you being here with me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure to be a colleague and friend over the years, Hans, and it's a special pleasure to be here with you today.
Great, thank you. Why don't you start off by you telling us a little bit about your career path and how you ended up at the U.S. Department of Education over the last few years?
Yeah, well, you know, starting out first and foremost as the son of a career and technical educator who spent 37 years all in the same school district, not the same classroom, the school consolidated a couple times around him, and a man who started teaching, actually was prepared under the Smith-Hughes Act and started his teaching career under the Smith-Hughes Act. I would say that I'm probably a little philosophically warped when it comes to career and technical education because my dad had experiences through the first five acts and then I came in midway and covered the rest of them. So between him and I, we've been involved in this space of career and technical education since about 1963. But my path then, I went to Purdue University, absolutely focused on a biochemical agricultural engineering degree. I was headed into the heavy science. And then I spent a year as a student, career and technical student organization state officer, and was traveling in classrooms most every day that year, and found that I was built to build people and build systems that build people. And so from there, I started teaching after getting my ag education degree at Purdue University. Taught at Manchester High School. And then shortly, I would have loved to have spent more years in the classroom, but an opportunity came available at National FFA to continue that work of building the personal and the employability skills of students that were focused on an agricultural pathway. So spent about a decade with National FFA and then had the opportunity to head with my wife to Colorado, to her home state, and get the experience with state leadership, both with programs in CTE, but then also the Career and Tech student organizations, and then spent 7 years as the state director of Career and Technical Education. And so all of those experiences have been a part of preparing me for the role that I've played over the past couple of years.
I see. Wow. I don't think I remember that about your father. That is really interesting. For our listeners who aren't familiar with some of the career technical education
background, the Smith-Hughes Act, originally passed in 1917, was the first federal investment in what used to be called vocational, technical, or maybe industrial arts, industrial education.
All of that was wrapped right up in there, Hans, yes. And it lasted for about 50 years, so from 1917 mm-hmm. to 63. And the numbers of students, and you know, America's education system was just forming at that point. And the debate then is the debate we still have today. What's the purpose of high school? And you had John Dewey on one side that was saying it all needs to be about liberal arts and general studies, just preparing them to be good citizens and to take a place in a community. And then you had David Snedden and Charles Prosser on the other side who were saying, no, we need skills to meet the workforce needs in our economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sounds very familiar to today's conversation.
It certainly does. The debate rages on. The other term we'll use during this discussion is the Perkins Act, which was the successor to the Smith-Hughes Act, which was at some point was renamed after Carl D. Perkins, congressman, chairman of the Education Committee from Kentucky. So anyway, that's a little terminology background. But tell us, so your background from Indiana to the National FFA, the what used to be called Future Farmers of America, and they're based in Indianapolis, correct?
Right. They moved while I was working for them from Alexandria, Virginia, on some of George Washington's old property to Indianapolis in 1998.
Okay, great. And then out to Colorado. So how did all those different career experiences influence your goals, your priorities moving into the U.S. Department of Education?
Yeah, I think all of those experiences shaped my time here as looking at things from a very practical approach from the local level. And, you know, and I'm blessed to work with a secretary who firmly believes that those that are closest to the learners make the best decisions, and that we at the federal level should not be overthinking or overstretching beyond and trying to shape their work in a way that might take them away from what they know is right for those learners. And coming from teaching in a classroom, coming from state leadership, I've tried very hard to provide the greatest flexibility to our states as they've been working on their Perkins 5 state plans, and encouraging them to put the learner first and really make it a learner-centric approach to the next 5, 10, 15 years of current technical education across the country.
Let's follow that idea then. What does a learner-centric approach to career technical education look like in your view?
Yeah, it becomes much more personalized. And I'll give you an example. My son Ross, who is second in our family, but early on when he was starting his, defining what his vocational or career identity would be. We're a very agricultural community. In the high school or the school district that they went to and that I was on the school board for, this year we only have 207 kiddos preschool through 12th grade. So very, very small school district. But early on in late middle school, he really focused in on the IT pathways. He loved computers and coding and really figuring out how to make the machines do more than what they were able to do before. And so he got his first industry certification. And now, for some of the learners, we'll have to clarify this terminology, but our school is an agricultural community. So his first opportunity was to get an AI certification, which is artificial insemination for cattle. And so, as his freshman and sophomore year, took care of that. And honestly, I was very pleased because I'm going, hey, he can be employed at one of the dairies, helping impregnate cattle all day long for $50,000 a year. Wow. But he used that to breed his own cows and create a registered bull that he then sold, took the money from that bull and bought his first Mac computer. Well, that was the pathway that he now was on. And so he signed up and became a developer for the iTunes App Store, created a couple of different apps that ended up paying for the next succession of computers that he bought as he headed off to college. But our small school district couldn't afford to have an IT instructor or someone to teach coding. And it was only through partnerships with the community college and ultimately Ross learning on his own through Google searches of how do you develop code that he was able to learn. And, you know, whether it be in a rural community or in an urban area where the school does not offer the specific program or the career path that a student is interested in, we've got the technology and the ability now to start personalizing these pathways in ways that go beyond just offering a class. And whether that's competency-based or distanced learning approaches, you know, as we look to the future, I do see students acquiring information in lots of different ways that open up lots more multiple pathways within the K-12 system.
I see. Now, at the U.S. Department of Ed, you probably had some funding that you could invest in some activities, some projects. Were there any things that you were investing toward personalized learning?
Absolutely. And great question. And yes, we do have this pot of national activities dollars that come along with the general formula funds with Perkins. And so we'll be announcing here within a couple of weeks the winners of the Rural Tech Challenge, which was designed to do just that, of allowing smaller school districts that might not have access to instructional capacity in these high demand areas to put in place a system that takes advantage of distance learning technology, and that could either be, you know, synchronous, asynchronous, it could be face-to-face, it could be all distance, but it also needs to build in a competency-based component, because in many cases, students are ready to go farther faster than we give them credit for, and by confining them to specific seat time basis, we start to limit their trajectory. Because Ross, and I told you he was AI certified for artificial insemination, but today he works for Trimble in their AI machine learning, so the artificial intelligence space of a large geospatial company, and absolutely loves both of his AI certifications that he acquired along the way. Right. So we've invested in that space. We also have invested in STEM apprenticeships. 2 years ago, we released a series of grants that are really taking high school and allowing through either virtual apprenticeships or face-to-face apprenticeships, a chance for young learners to get out into the workplace and define their pathway by their apprenticeship versus the courses that they're taking at the high school. So really trying to push the needle of how we think about doing CTE and getting it beyond the classroom walls.
Okay. On that first point, I was talking with some educators in rural Pennsylvania last week, and they said because of the COVID distance learning mandate, I guess is one way to say it, that they got a good investment from a tech company to do a lot of build out of their regional infrastructure. So the students all got laptops, and the tech company really started building out the broadband infrastructure. Are you seeing any kind of evidence of that more nationally, of really kind of fast forwarding the infrastructure that we need for rural technical distance learning because of COVID?
Absolutely. You know, the CARES Act put in place a tremendous amount of resources that state and local entities have been using. Now, granted, there still is, without question, a digital divide, but I do believe we're making some headway, and COVID has pushed us in that direction. And that will be one of the unanticipated, in my opinion, positive outcomes, is that, you know, a lot of school districts are for the first time having to move to that one-to-one computer ratio with their students. In addition to that, they're finding unique ways to put up and position hotspots. And, you know, we've heard the stories of parking the bus with a hotspot in the middle of a community. They're getting creative, and then to have private partners stepping alongside, like you said, in Pennsylvania, to really ensure that every student has access to, that learning, no matter their location.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. What are some other accomplishments that you're proud of from your tenure at Department of Ed?
Yeah, you know, the as you mentioned, the Rural Tech Challenge, we also have expanded work around apprenticeships in a lot of ways, trying to get the nation as a whole. Historically, we've looked at it in this country as we do education in the K-12 and the higher ed system. It's Department of Labor that does apprenticeships. Well, I've been trying to convince the world that we need to embrace, you know, apprenticeship is the oldest instructional strategy in the world. So why in the world wouldn't we find a way to embrace it within the education structure, whether that be in the high school or the community college setting? Well, then we start to unpack that a little bit. And there are some barriers of students that are 16 and 17 year olds being in the workplace. And so we just last week had a gathering of the Secretary of Education, the Secretary of Labor, and the President and CEO of the Society for Human Resource Management, Johnny Taylor, gather together and say, it's time that we change this, because we're at the lowest point, Hans, of youth participation in the workplace that our country has ever seen. Only about 1 in 3, when we look at the summer employment as well as the during the school year employment, only about 1 in 3 students are having any kind of work experience in any given year. And that's less for students of color and students that are out of below the poverty line. And so we were so pleased last week to raise that issue, provide a call to action, and then we're going to be releasing within the next week a request for information for practitioners all across the country to really inform us, how do we on the federal level, and what are ways that we can work with states to open up those opportunities for learners as they're working their way through the system. And the other piece that I'm really excited about was the National Council for the American Worker, which the president stood up 2 years ago in the summer of 2018, and calling on all of the federal government to say, how are we preparing, and what, how are we building a talent pipeline in this country that values skills equally with degrees, and in many cases values competency attainment over just degree attainment. Really kind of reshaping the national workforce strategy. And so on behalf of the secretary, our office has been the lead on staffing that work and really providing the underpinning of how can we reshape our education system to really be more competency centric than just degree attainment centric.
How do people find out more information about the work of that commission?
Yeah, so the National Council is hosted, and the chair of that is actually within the Department of Commerce. And so if you go to the Department of Commerce's site and dig into the National Council for the American Worker or the American Worker Public Advisory Board, there's lots of great resources. Last summer, the work released a new website called findsomethingnew.org in partnership with the Ad Council. And that website really focuses in on the in-demand jobs that are out there that individuals can work towards, whether that be in IT or healthcare or manufacturing, that don't require that baccalaureate degree, but provide a skill base that leads to someone getting immediately employed, you know, really well-paying job, with the opportunity to continue on to a bachelor's degree if they choose to. So it's all about pathways that we have not necessarily pushed in this country for the past 30 years.
That's excellent. Let's go back to the apprenticeship issue. I know that in setting up an apprenticeship, there's a pretty rigorous process of identifying the knowledge and skills statements that will be part of the apprenticeship, and that the employer has to take some responsibility for supporting those. There's an educational component to the apprenticeship. So that there's a lot of heavy lifting in setting it up for just 5 students in a locality. What do you see? How can you bring some scalability to those processes so that it's more doable for businesses that want to be involved, but maybe just feel a little daunted by the process?
Yeah, I looked at the example in your home state of Maryland with Apprenticeship Maryland, and I was recently out in the Hagerstown area at the school district, and what they're doing is in complete partnership with the local workforce job center, the workforce board staff, and then more importantly, they are taking, and part of it begins with, you know, instructionally, in all of our CTE programs, we have a list of defined competencies that have been established for each of them. So that lift is already complete. Then it's a question of going to the employer and saying, which of these skills can we sign off on and have you document in the workplace? And that's where the Labor Department, the local job center, comes into play with the staff that are helping make it easier on the employers to say yes to that. And then, and they're doing things from, you know, whether that be the furniture cabinet making to, diesel truck repair to a young lady that had just completed the program, was working for the county, working at the water reclamation facility because she was wanting an environmental science pathway. So the width and breadth, like you said, it becomes more one-offs, But again, that goes back to the personalized ability of the pathway to create what that learner is truly interested in and gives them a chance to experience it before they spend $100,000 on a baccalaureate degree in environmental science to know whether they like it or not. So yes, it is a different lift, but I would contend that it is not a heavier lift because most of the components are there if we start to look at it as a systems approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. So let's go to the Perkins Act, which was reauthorized in 2016. Is that correct?
Oh, 2018. Okay. Passed in mid-July and then was signed by the president on the 30th of July, 2 days after I started. Oh. I didn't get invited to the signing ceremony, so I guess I was a little too new, but I've let it go.
All right. You're not holding on to that. So what were some of the what, in your opinion, the most significant changes from Perkins 5, the fifth version of the Perkins Act versus the previous version?
You bet. And, you know, it really was smaller tweaks and amendments. It wasn't a complete overhaul. But there were some things that were significant that states have taken hold of in their state plans. And, you know, the first of those being really defining and allowing, giving permission to go down to the fifth grade in middle school and start that career exploration and awareness process much earlier. Which had always been before just an age, which didn't quite fit. And so many states were hesitant to invest dollars there, knowing that there might be a finding. So giving full permission in middle school to start earlier. The second one, the comprehensive local needs assessment, was a significant shift. And I will tell you, and Hans, you've been around this space a long time, if we in current technical education had been doing our job of having local advisory committees that were operating and informing our programs and telling us which we needed to get rid of and which we needed to expand and where our shortfalls were, I don't think Congress would have had to put in the comprehensive local needs assessment. But over the past 20 years, we really, rightfully so, have been focusing on the trend in education, which is greater academic alignment. And yes, we have done a great job in that space. But I think employers are telling us, okay, we need to return to our roots and really be the entity in the education system that is focused on meeting the needs of our local communities and bridging that divide between education and the economy. And so comprehensive local needs assessment was a big piece of, you know, because right now it defines any Perkins investment at the local level has to be identified as a need in that comprehensive local needs assessment process. It also, and this is one of the things that I think most people don't talk about when they talk about the Perkins Act, but that comprehensive local needs assessment also requires a gap analysis among our special populations and students of color and saying, are we serving all students with this program? And do they have access to be a part of a wonderful health program? And through this work, we know that there are some school districts where, they may offer a program, but just because it's 2 to 3 miles away, certain populations are not able to access it. And so it's going to create some great opportunities for more students to have access to high quality CTE. The third one then, the secondary measure, work-based learning, that was included that states could choose as one of their quality indicators. And happy to report that 26 states plus the District of Columbia did select work-based learning as their secondary quality indicator. And so we'll be looking and keeping a close eye on that over the next few years to see how they're finding success in that space.
Yeah. Yeah. One of we're starting to see some of the impact of that. We have our seamless work-based learning app. And we have a statewide contract to implement that in one of the states, and another one perhaps to come. So,
yeah, and I know many states have been concerned because they have not had a reporting vehicle or a way to gather that information. So for the first time, with your app and many others, we'll be having a path to actually get a picture of how many students are truly participating in these experiences.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you about the comprehensive local needs assessment. And I think this might be somewhat just how it's interpreted locally. I have heard from time to time state officials, maybe local officials, who take a very somewhat narrow view in my mind of what is a local in-demand career path. So within a state, it's really not uncommon at all for people to move within a state or from a rural area to more suburbanized urban area for job opportunities. So there may be plenty of job opportunities within a state, but maybe not within a region of that state. Do you feel that that the CLNA requirement about demonstrating a local opportunity is broad enough to take care of people moving within a state? Or I guess the downside would be if something that was a really good program was kind of shut down because you couldn't document local jobs, but there were still jobs within the state.
Great question. And we did defer to states and allowed the widest flexibility. But coming from my role as a state director in Colorado, we absolutely would have allowed a regional approach or, you know, for some specific areas, if there was a high demand within the state that we were absolutely not meeting, then yeah, that could be tailored to any of the communities that were willing to offer and step into that space of preparing individuals. You know, the key piece is that we are not in alignment. You know, prior to COVID, we were at 7 million jobs that were unfilled because across the nation, there were employers looking but could not find individuals with the skills to fill those jobs. And last week at our symposium on work-based learning, Johnny Taylor, President and CEO of SHRM, said, you know, that hasn't gone away. COVID did not take away the gap that we were in. Right. What it did was put it on pause. And he says, there is still going to be a war on talent coming out of as we emerge and the economy starts to resurge post-pandemic. That need is going to be there. And local school boards, regional consortiums, partnerships with community colleges are going to be the solution of that. And they probably will have to redo or at least do a shortened version of their comprehensive local needs assessment data poll. But best case scenario, yes, there are some CTE programs that are being offered just because of high student interest, but do not take a student on a pathway. And those are the ones that we really need to be focused in on to say, how do we phase them out or how do we move and reutilize that critical infrastructure space of a classroom and instructional time to really target those industries where we need to move forward in?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of question marks about the culinary arts programs and the hospitality industry that have just been devastated by the COVID crisis. They were always very high student interest, but sometimes harder to document a clear career path to a family-sustaining wage in some of those. So,
right. And those are the conversations, Hans, that we're hoping are happening locally. And happy to report some of them are having them, others are not. It's a big country, and you're going to get the full spectrum of the bell curve on those conversations, I'm sure. Yeah.
And certainly, I think a lot of people have just been in survival mode the last 7 or 8 months.
You bet.
So you mentioned how some states have decided to make work-based learning a key indicator of their program quality. What are some other positive trends that you're seeing among the states and the ways that they're implementing the Perkins Act?
Yeah, we saw a couple things that I'm very excited about. One of them being that we did have more states, because under Perkins 4, states were allowed to do what's called a combined plan with WIOA, so that partnership with the Workforce Investment and Opportunity Act, really having a shared vision across all of their talent development systems. And I'll be honest with you, in the work under the last act, it came later. It wasn't in the first round of state plans, and it ended up being really just taking two PDF documents and merging them together, and that became their combined plan. The ones this time around, which there were 9 states that have said yes to enter into that work of a shared vision across their state for workforce development. And in those 9 plans, they are completely integrated. You know, Perkins is right in, and it's interwoven with the rest of the workforce programs, whether that be the adult, the youth, the adult education dollars. All of them are focused in on where do we best invest the resources to move the system forward in the same direction. The second one that I would say is the use of the reserve fund. You know, Perkins allowed 5, allowed for instead of 10%, 15% of the state, or for the state to be able to hold back to spark innovation and to provide larger grants for new areas of emerging programs of study. And so more states, 90% of the states, are now using that reserve fund, with a variety of them using the full amount to do competitive grants on an annual basis to really spark growth in the areas that are needed.
Right. Okay, let's take a break and hear from our sponsor.
This episode of The Power of Career Connected Learning is sponsored by Seamless Work-Based Learning. Are you trying to get employers connected with programs your school and college offers? Do you want to help your educators manage work-based learning and their advisory boards with less time and better results? Would you like to have access to real-time data on WBL across your campus or district? If so, then Seamless Work-Based Learning is the solution you're looking for. Seamless WBL is an online scheduling and customer management system specifically designed around the need to manage all your work-based learning activities. It helps you manage current partners, set up and manage work-based learning activities, engage your advisory boards, provide access to your employers and students, and run reports on work-based learning activity. Go to seamlesswbl.com today and sign up for a free, no-obligation demo and walkthrough of the system. Remember, sign up at seamlesswbl.com.
All right, welcome back to The Power of Career Connected Learning. I'm Hans Meter, and today I am interviewing Scott Stump, the Assistant Secretary for Career, Technical, and Adult Education at the U.S. Department of Education.
What do you see in terms of the interconnection between career technical education and broader education reform? And it seems like, in some ways, that broader discussion, I don't know if it's fizzled or I just haven't been paying attention.
But it's focused on one thing, which is survival at this point, right?
Yes. So, but how do you see career technical education either being part of the reform discussion, or maybe being pushed off to the sidelines? What are you seeing in terms of that connection?
Yeah, maybe I'm too hopeful, but I think the stars are converging for career and technical education over the next decade to take a completely different space in the wider education conversation. You know, since A Nation at Risk came out in the early 80s, it has driven American education system on one path and one path only, and that has been to higher attainment on the standardized tests. Which, without question, having students that are competent in math and language arts and science is absolutely important and a requirement. But in that time, we know that it decimated the, as you mentioned earlier, the industrial arts programs in middle school, where a student could go have kind of a tech ed experience and become a maker, even though we didn't call it maker spaces back then. That really was what it was. And it created the innovators and the entrepreneurs of my generation, because they all of a sudden they learned, okay, I can do this and find a way to create my own role in the future. But those programs were set aside with the agenda of the day. And yet today we find ourselves, as we were talking earlier, with $1.5 trillion in federal financial aid student loans that individuals across this country are carrying. And I just read a report that was in the Washington Post this morning and a couple of other places that about 40% of recent college graduates, so people with baccalaureate degrees, 40% of them are working in jobs that don't require a baccalaureate degree. And based on all of those factors and the fact that parents are now questioning the return on investment of the advanced education, we're starting to have different conversations about how do we take that next step after high school. You also have companies, what is it? There were 18 different ones 2 years ago that came out and said, we are not going to be putting degrees on as a requirement on our job postings. Because what we find is that it's about individuals and competencies that are more important than just the degree that they have. And whether that's in the IT and the coding sectors, which is the ones that were the first to lead on that space, or other industries, we're on a path to really looking at what does someone know and be able to do? How can they bring that as value to our industry, being a larger deciding factor? And I think then the education system is going to have to shift to be able to compensate for what those employers are looking for. Mm-hmm.
It is interesting how things are shifting. I hope you're right. I hope we're moving toward that tipping point. We started at NC3T, started using the term career-connected learning as a broad overview concept that incorporates career technical education. But hopefully, sometimes when people hear anything with the word career, they immediately think of old voc ed, and trying to engage the concept that every student gets strong career development, every student gets the opportunity to participate in some sort of career-connected learning experience and work-based learning experience. I hope we get there soon. So,
absolutely, because otherwise, then we have individuals graduating from 2-year and 4-year degree paths, having never experienced the world of work. And you know, with the numbers that I'm looking at, we're putting out a whole generation that, knows education but has no direct experience or authentic experience in the world of work. And it's no wonder to me that employers are saying, hey, they don't have the skills. Well, what they're talking about is not the technical skills. They're talking about the assimilated to the work environment skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to bring up something relating to minority students, particularly Black Americans, who have a history, a cultural memory of being told you're not college material, but there's this vocational program here, maybe you should try that instead. Whether that's, I definitely think there's historical truth there, but it's a strong cultural memory. And at times when career technical and career connected learning programs have been proposed, there's a concern. Is my child going to be tracked away from a 4-year college experience? Have you had any conversations with leaders in the African American community that you feel have really unpacked those historical concerns and looked at it in a new light?
You know, this will go back to my prior experiences of working with you know, national FFA, and then working within the state of Colorado, that whether it be African-American students or Hispanic students of color in general, especially within the industry of agriculture, have really different views about that experience because of the roles that their forefathers and mothers were placed in. And absolutely, having conversations about the opportunities that are available is a different conversation. And I would say that's where I have high hope for the requirement in the comprehensive local needs assessment to have candid conversations locally about why are these students not. So take, for instance, the pre-engineering pathways that, the STEM pathways, the Project Lead the Way and others have put in place in many schools, or PTEC that IBM has used across the Northeast and is expanding out. Definitely a wonderful earn and learn opportunities for all students. Well, looking at the disaggregated data, we need to have those hard conversations locally, and then figure out a plan of how to make sure that all of our students, and especially students of color, have access to high quality CTE. Because if we go back to and we're only offering certain pathways to those students, then we're going to be exactly where we don't want to be moving forward in the future. We need to have all of the talent taking a look at these opportunities and being able to say yes to them because they're accessible, they're in a building that's close, or that they're being taught in a way that those students can find their place within those pathways.
Mm-hmm. Are there any urban CTE systems that you would point to that you feel are making significant progress in improving the quality and the availability toward students of color in all different economic spectrums?
You know, there's a... Not to toot my own horn of home of Colorado, but I would say that the Denver public school system in the past 10 to 15 years has made significant strides in this space of really ensuring that it doesn't matter what the zip code of the city you're coming from or what school you've been regionally zoned into, that you have access to high quality CTE programs and that there are a variety of pathways that are available. You know, I looked to the Academies model in Nashville and had the chance 2 years ago in the fall to, on our back to school tour, go visit and see McGavick school, high school, that has absolutely offered to students from all over that city really, really high quality pathways from banking and finance to criminal justice, to health careers. All of them are available there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, from what I've observed there, they have erased the stigma and the concern that parents might have about those programs. So they see them as a real positive stepping stone for opportunity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you have your official job as an assistant secretary to help implement the Perkins Act as enacted by Congress. So beyond that, what are your personal hopes and aspirations for career technical education?
Yeah. Well, get to go to the far end of the spectrum of what in my mind would be a great reality is that all students, whether they know it or not, would be in, as you said earlier, this career-connected learning experience. I think for our nation, that's going to be the solution to the future. Starting earlier and giving students that chance to explore, become aware, test things. I know that it's been impactful for the children in my family, the three kids that I have, really intentionally trying to give them experiences within their career path. And that has shaped each of their three decisions. And in many cases saying, no, I don't want to do that. And I need to head in another direction, or latching onto it and saying, absolutely, that's the right path for me. And whether that ends up turning into a two-year or an industry certification or a two-year degree or a four-year degree, all of those possibilities are available because of the great work that our educators have been doing in the stackable credential space and really working to integrate and eliminate what I would call a terminal degree, which is, okay, you've taken this industry certification, but it really won't carry you on to a baccalaureate degree. And I think we're becoming smarter in that space of transferring them in. So all students having some kind of what I would consider a career-connected experience while they're working through high school.
Is there a national resource on those stackable credentials that you would point us to?
There is, and it's available at cte.ed.gov. And if you look under the National Initiatives section, there's a wide variety of resources from work-based learning to stackable credentials to apprenticeships and how to set them up locally for high school students. And but we'll keep putting resources there to add to that. But yes, new resources on stackable credentials are there.
Very good. One of your other responsibilities, so your office, the Career Technical and Adult Education, tell us about the adult education side of your office and how that links to both workforce development and career technical education.
Yeah, we are the hub of the connection between the Department of Labor and the rest of the Department of Education. Some have even pontificated that maybe we ought to merge those two and that we ought to just jump over to the Department of Labor. But nothing, that would take an act of Congress, literally, to have happen. But it is our point of connection. And so adult education, we serve about 1.2 million adult learners in any given year who, for whatever reason, didn't get the math and the language arts skills that they needed to be ready to step into either future employment or step back into a post-secondary education system. In addition to that, we also gather our immigrants and others who are needing to acquire the English language, so the English language learners, and set them up with the skills, again, for employment or advancement in post-secondary education. And, you know, that the area the latest work from the PIAC, which is an international survey, estimates that we're about 51 million adults from the ages of 16 to 74 now, because as we expand that age to retirement, we've got to look at that whole window. But about 51 million Americans are at low basic skill levels. And to truly get them to have a chance for economic mobility and a chance to expand their condition, they need skills. And so we stand on the front line of that space, ready to equip them with the skills they need.
Is that 51 million adult Americans?
Adult Americans, 51 million.
So that's one out of every four, maybe, adults?
Yes.
Wow.
And so we've got a lot of work to do in that space.
Wow. Let's finish up with a leadership question. You've exerted leadership at many different levels. What are some leadership insights that you would share with our listeners?
You know, long ago, I was a fan of the way that John Maxwell defined leadership, and that leadership is influence. and that influence can only happen, yes, within your position. So in my position as assistant secretary, I have a certain bit of latitude. I can sign off on certain things and say yes. But especially within the Department of Education, you know, current technical and adult education is a very small component of the wider work. When you think of the Office of Post-Secondary Education that has hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars that go out in the form of grants, the expansion of the Title I dollars in our Office of Elementary and Secondary Education is having a significant and a much larger influence just because of the dollars that they're sending out. And so my little leadership insight is don't be bound by the box that you're in of where your authority is at. And what Maxwell would say is, and it's a good book, Developing the Leader Within You, is that to get beyond the rights that you have in your position, you have to develop relationships. And so much of what I've been doing the past couple of years is reaching out beyond our specific office walls into other parts of not just the Department of Education, but the Department of Labor, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Health and Human Services, to expand and earn the right to provide leadership and to guide those agencies and the work that they're doing and showing the connection to career and technical education and positioning it as a part of their collective success.
Thank you so much, Scott, for sharing with us today your work. Wish you well for wherever you are in the future. So thanks again for joining us.
You bet. Pleasure to be here, Hans.
Thanks again to Assistant Secretary Scott Stump for his insight and visionary leadership. You can check out the show notes for this podcast at the NC3T website, nc3t.com/podcast, and you will find links so that you can get more information about Assistant Secretary Stump and the initiatives that he referenced during our conversation. Also, I want to thank those of you who share this show on social media and ask that you use the hashtag PowerCCL so that we can see what you're posting. And please do one of the following: subscribe, download episodes, rate us, write a review of the show. All of these things help us gain better visibility and reach more listeners with the message of career-connected learning. And as we close this program, remember, let's keep our eyes on the goal, helping every young person pursue a vibrant life and a meaningful career through the power of career-connected learning. I'm Hans Meter. Thank you.